The following lecture is part of the Quid Est Homo lecture series offered by the Personalist Project, a non-profit organization in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Recordings of our lectures are available free of charge at our website. For more information or to make a donation in support of our work, please visit us at www.thepersonalistproject.org.
Thank you all so much for coming. It's great to see you here for the third in our Quid Est Homo series. As I've explained to those of you who were here before, Quid Est Homo, What is Man, is taken from Psalm 8. And it is meant to be a series to lead us all in deeper reflection on the various mysteries of personal existence. Our first, by Alice von Hildebrand, was on the person and truth, the way a person simultaneously sort of dreads the truth and longs for it. The second, by Maria Federica, on the person being created in love and created for love. Those two talks are already available for downloading at our website. Dr. Healy's talks also will be in short order available at our website. So this third topic, now we turn to the question of the ultimate end of personal existence. You know, as Christians, of course, we live in the awareness that there are two radically different possible ends to human life: eternal life and damnation. And these two possibilities, of course, lend this tremendous high drama to the whole of human life and to even each of our individual moral acts and attitudes. It invests human life with an enormous amount of meaning and seriousness. And yet, I think maybe particularly in our age, we find it difficult to comprehend the mysteriousness of we have a God that we believe is all-loving, is all-merciful, is all-forgiving, and is all-powerful. How do we hold this truth together with the truth that there is the possibility of eternal damnation? It is this great mystery that Dr. Healy is going to lead us in reflecting on tonight. I want to make sure that we note, though, Dr. Healy is not a theologian, much less a bishop. He's not speaking authoritatively, he's speaking philosophically. He's leading us in reflection, and with, you know, the kind of philosophy the Personalist Project is interested in and the kind of philosophy Dr. Healy does, it invites response. It invites you to think along with him. Test what he says, his argument, against your own interior sense of truth. Does this make sense? Is it clear? And he welcomes your feedback, your objections, your challenges, your questions. And we intend to leave plenty of time for that tonight. However, we do ask, because we know that there are some people who would like to hear both talks and might not be able to stay late, we will hold all the talk, all the questions and objections and so forth until after the second talk. So if you have particular ones that you want to raise with him during the break, that's fine too. So once again, the goal for tonight is not to solve the mystery of damnation, but to come closer to appreciating it well and rightly. Now let me give you a little bit of background on Dr. Healy. I recently reread a very engaging article of his, which he wrote in InsideCatholic.com, which I highly recommend to all of you, about his own discovery of philosophy. He said he was a psychology major at the Loyola University, which is now Loyola Marymount, I think, in Los Angeles, in 1970, when the wave sweeping the church was of doctrinal heterodoxy, moral relativism. All this was beginning to come in. It was very exciting. It was very enticing. And Dr. Healy admits that he was beginning to drift in that direction until two speakers came to campus, two contrasting speakers. One was Hans Küng, and one was Dietrich von Hildebrand. His talk was, in the end, delivered by his widow, Alice von Hildebrand. But he said it was the contrasting encounter with these two personalities and these two great Catholic intellectuals that changed the course of his life. He switched his major to philosophy. He went on to doctoral studies at the University of Dallas. He did a dissertation, I believe, on David Hume there, studying under the disciples of von Hildebrand, Joseph Seifert, and John F. Crosby, also teachers of ours in Liechtenstein. Since then, he has taught philosophy. He's published articles and given addresses in the areas of metaphysics, epistemology, aesthetics, philosophy of language, philosophy of the person, ethics, and philosophy of religion. He has a special love for Soren Kierkegaard, Dietrich von Hildebrand, and Karol Wojtyła, all, of course, mainstays and inspirations of the Personalist Project. He has a forthcoming book a primer in the philosophy of John Paul II in his own words, to be published one day by St. Augustine Press. Jules and I first met Dr. Healy in 1986 when we were undergraduates at Franciscan University. Because Dr. Healy is that very extremely rare thing, a philosopher with administrative talent, he was recruited by Father Michael Scanlon to become the academic dean of Franciscan University. And his impact on that institution was enormous, and it was immediately felt. This was, well, if we could say that Father Michael brought Franciscan University alive religiously, Dr. Healy's deanship brought it alive intellectually and academically. This was especially obvious in the philosophy department. When he came, there were two philosophy majors. Within a handful of years, with Dr. Healy teaching one course a semester and Dr. Healy having hired another von Hildebrandian, Professor James Harold, within a handful of years, there were 50 philosophy majors. Today, there are over 200. There is an MA program with over 50. One of his first acts as dean was to organize and host a Christian culture conference, which brought such luminaries to campus as Tom Howard, I think Stanley Yockey was there, and Alice von Hildebrand. Jules and I, you know, just sort of young, naive, sort of academically uninterested students, went to this conference and were absolutely electrified. This was, for us, a sort of completely new avenues opening up. And afterwards, we made a point of getting to meet Alice von Hildebrand and saying, where can we get more of this? And she said immediately and enthusiastically, take Dr. Healy's course on the nature of love. And so that's what we did. He was our first philosophy professor, the first real one. We had had others that don't count. He introduced us to the thought of von Hildebrand, to Carol Wojtyła, to Soren Kierkegaard, to Joseph Pieper. Even more than that, I would say, in his way of teaching, he communicated a true love of truth and an absolute high delight in being able to communicate this truth to his students. And it was so inspiring to see him living this truth and loving this truth and sharing this truth that it really did turn our own ideas for our own life around as well. Dr. Healy encouraged us to go on in graduate school. He's written many letters of recommendation for us over the years, and he continues to encourage us by agreeing to serve as a founding director of the Personalist Project, for which we're very grateful. He and his Austrian-born wife, Maria, have 5 children, so far 3 grandchildren. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Healy. There's water for you.
Well, I thank you, Katie, for that very exuberant introduction, and hopefully I'll try to be worthy of it tonight. Let me just mention, too, the book I had done on Wojtyła has been accepted for publication on the condition I can work out the copyright permissions, which has grown into a big tangle. Eventually, I have to probably hire a lawyer to help, so I don't know when that will happen. Now, turning to the topic, first, of course, it's not the usual topic that most people get interested in, to go deeper into hell, you see. And I might say the way it came about was in my introduction to philosophy course and in metaphysics, we treat of the problem of evil in connection with God and how to offer some defense of God being all good and all powerful, even though evil has a reality, you see. And so that was sort of the indirect way I got more interested in this topic. But it is a sort of an awful topic, and so I'll consider it a compliment if after the lecture you tell me how awful it was, you see. So. Now, Pope Benedict made headlines around the world in the spring of 2007 by warning of the real existence of hell and of its eternal nature. And he said, quote, even if nobody talks about it much anymore. But it's a topic we should take seriously and attempt to understand, though it's unpleasant and involves difficult problems. I wish to address here in part one a particular objection against the reality of hell that might be raised precisely by believers. That is, in light of redemption, in light of the idea, in light of the redemption, the idea that men and women might be sent to such a place seems to be completely incompatible with the God of absolute love and mercy, the God revealed in Christian revelation. Moreover, if you say that the one who rejects God's mercy must then face his justice, we've probably heard that line, this seems to imply that God's mercy runs out, or is limited, or is not coextensive with his justice. But that would seem to be completely unacceptable. And so, as von Balthasar writes, quote, thus where God's mercy, which is obviously taken as finite here, wears thin, it remains for, quote, pure justice, unquote, to assert itself. Now, von Balthasar, of course, objects to this. And so he says, now, since precisely this sort of assumption that divine qualities are finite is not acceptable, a dispute arises about whether one who is under judgment as a Christian can have hope for all men. And this is Hans Urs von Balthasar in his book, Dare We Hope That All Men Might Be Saved, together with a short discourse on hell. Now, in confronting this objection, we must attempt, I think, to look more closely, if we can, at the inner attitudes present in those in hell, according to Revelation, at least the devil and his angels, and to try to understand the compatibility of hell with absolute love and mercy. That's sort of the challenge. Moreover, this is also important for critics of von Balthasar. That is, those who would, raises objections to the idea that we should think that human beings are in hell. He never says no one is, but he raises objections to it. But anyone who criticizes von Balthasar would also have to offer some explanation of how mercy and justice are one and coextensive even in hell, and how in the end God can be all in all, even though there seems to be some permanent residue of evil and conflict. How can ongoing evil and consequent suffering associated with it be incorporated into a final consummation of loving goodness in eternity? Naturally, we're dealing here with a deep mystery that cannot be simply wrapped up and explained in rationalistic terms. We can no more perfectly describe or explain hell than we can explain heaven, about which it is said, eye hath not seen, nor has ear heard, of course, what God has in store for those who love him. Nevertheless, using parallels from our own human experience of evil and suffering, I think we can to some extent illustrate and better understand the doctrine of hell and its possible compatibility with God's perfect love and mercy. To do so, we have to try to look at the suffering of the damned from the inside, from the perspective of inner personal experience, phenomenologically, if you will, rather than just from the perspective of outward facts and appearances or outward visions. So let's investigate how far we can go in such a direction. Hell ultimately has to do with the choice of self over God, where self is misconstrued as a false absolute. So C.S. Lewis points out in The Problem of Pain, this is a possibility inherent in the creation of any free contingent person. In other words, as soon as God creates you free, you have the possibility of choosing self over God. That comes with the gift of freedom. So evil involves a lie, the lie that the self is supreme. It involves, then, a lack of reality contact and even a forceful rejection of reality to the point of both denial and hatred of truth and reality in favor of the self and its desires. This is why it is said that the devil was a liar from the beginning. And the first one he lied to and remains stuck in his lie was himself. Interestingly, M. Scott Peck, a psychologist who converted to Christianity after participating in two exorcisms as a professional observer when he was still a secular psychologist, but he found no psychological explanation that could do justice to what he saw, and he eventually converted. He wrote a book about evil entitled People of the Lie. In this work, he tries to categorize evil as a type of psychological disorder requiring much further study. By calling it a psychological disorder, he's by no means absolving those involved, his patients or clients, of responsibility, but he's just trying to situate it psychologically. And he notes that the key to evil is that those involved are people of the lie. They lie to themselves and refuse to recognize reality, preferring to remain within themselves and reject self-discovery, self-modification, and the need to change. He calls it a radical type of narcissistic personality disorder. Any real reverence or humility before something intrinsically good or valuable or worthy or beautiful, or any real communion with another person for more than just selfish reasons, would be an escape from the self-enclosed trap. But this is precisely what the evil man rejects. He rejects a real reverence before values and before other people, and insists on himself and on the way he is, rather than to accept a way out. Now, as Kierkegaard says in his work on despair entitled The Sickness Unto Death, quote, "And ask help of any other? No, that for all the world he will not do. If it came to that, he would rather be himself with all the torments of hell than ask for help." Receiving help to get out of his self-enclosed isolation would be too much of a humiliation, an offense to his pride. Kierkegaard elaborates, quote, "But the more consciousness there is in such a sufferer who wants in despair to be himself, the more the despair intensifies and becomes the demonic. It usually begins like this. A self which is in despair wants to be himself, suffers some kind of pain which cannot be removed or separated from his concrete self. He then heaps upon this torment all his passion, which then becomes a demonic rage. If it should now appear that God in heaven and all the angels were to offer to help him to be rid of this torment, no, he does not want that. Now it is too late. Once he would gladly have given everything to be rid of this agony, but he was kept waiting. And now all that's past. He prefers to rage against everything and be the one whom the whole world and all existence has wronged, the one for whom it is especially important to ensure that he has his agony on hand so that no one will take it from him, for then he would not be able to convince others and himself that he is right." Finish the quote. Thus, in demonic despair, the self wants to be itself, even in misery, precisely as an expression of the hatred toward all existence. The despairer thinks that he himself is this evidence against God and against existence, and he wants to exist. Indeed, he insists on his own existence, even in terrible pain and misery, as a malicious objection to the whole of existence. Yet this vengeful self-assertion and consuming anger is also inescapably known to be both completely impotent against God and completely self-ruining. From this perspective, non-existence would be preferred. As it is quoted in Cry of a Lost Soul, this is an imprimatur little pamphlet dating back to the first part of the 20th century from Eastern Europe and purporting to be a sort of a forced account or report from a soul in hell. And I quote it not because I regard it as authoritative in any way, it's just a private sort of revelation, but simply because it illustrates things which fit with what the great theologians have said. This is a quote from Cry of a Lost Soul, from a soul in hell, quote, "Would that I had never existed. Would that I could now annihilate myself. But I must continue to exist as I chose to make myself, as a ruined person." Unquote. So the damned are stuck in this despairing, rebellious attitude. As it says in Psalm 102, quote, "As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our iniquities from us, However, if you have falsely identified yourself with your iniquities, and they are put as far as the east is from the west compared to your inescapable being made for God, what then? Well, then you're afflicted with a terrible spiritual pain and an experience of a perpetual tearing yourself in two as a person. As it's described in Le Dictionnaire de Théologie Catholique, a French work, the Dictionary of Catholic Theology, quote, "Therefore, the damned suffers a kind of rending asunder of the very soul, torn in two directions at once by equally powerful opposing forces. It is a kind of dismembering of the spirit, a torture all the more dreadful in that he feels as though it were his body which is being flayed alive or cut in pieces. For as much as the faculties of the soul are superior to those of the body, by so much the more painful is this deep rending which cuts the soul apart from itself in cutting it apart from God, God who is meant to be the soul of man's soul and the life of his life," unquote. Thus the damned suffer a complex and paradoxical experience of utter despair. In Kierkegaard's terms, they simultaneously suffer from a despair of not willing to be themselves, that is, their true selves, and a despair of willing to be themselves, their false selves, in defiance and in pure self-assertion. Yet they know all this is useless and without end. Thus, despite the prideful self-assertion, they also condemn themselves in perpetual self-reproach and remorse, but without any repentance. On several levels, then, they're tearing themselves apart. Most deeply, of course, this pain comes from the loss of God and the reproach of self because of it. Again, as is reported in Cry of a Lost Soul, quote, "Our greatest torture consists in the certain knowledge that we will never see God. How can this torture us so much since on earth we were so indifferent? As long as the knife lies on the table, it leaves you cold. You see how keen it is, but you do not feel it. Plunge the knife into the flesh and you will start screaming for pain. Now we feel the loss of God. Before we only thought of it," unquote. Let us proceed to examine some further aspects of this inner experience of this type of self-enclosed existence. Another characteristic would be the absolute loneliness of those in hell due to complete self-absorption, the refusal to look up to anything worthy of reverence, the rejection of all goods, beauty, values, and any possible communion with others based in the good. This metaphysical loneliness involves ultimately a complete tedium and boredom as well, for there is nothing worth being interested in, nothing worth communicating about except one's own self-absorption. The problem, of course, is that unless there's some common good in which persons can meet, no real communion is possible. So as Wojtyła says in his great work, Love and Responsibility, quote, "The only escape from this otherwise inevitable egoism is by recognizing beyond any purely subjective good an objective good which can unite persons. Such an objective common good is the foundation of love, and individual persons who jointly choose a common good in so doing subject themselves to it," unquote. But since those in hell insist on the lie, on their own self-enclosed pride, there is no communion or community at all in hell, though there may be many spirits and souls there. The possible crowds, as it says in the gospel, "My name is Legion, for we are many," form no real community. Each soul is in complete eternal isolation, for there is no willingness, no ability to meet in a common and objective good. So now we've expanded our descriptive determinants of hellish experience on the spiritual level. A spiteful, malicious resentment against the whole of existence, an impotent rage, tearing oneself asunder, utter self-reproach and despair, together with total loneliness, tedious self-absorption, and a complete lack of both rational communication and genuine communion. There's some areas here where I can later expand this talk about rational communication and the lack of it. For instance, C.S. Lewis, in his work Perelandra, offers an illustration about this. He says, he refers to it as an it, meaning the devil speaking through Weston, who is this possessed character that Lewis calls the unman. He says, it showed plenty of subtlety and intelligence when talking to the lady, trying to tempt her to sin. The possessed unman, well, but Ransom, he's the guy trying to save the lady from sinning, soon perceived that it regarded intelligence simply and solely as a weapon, which it had no more wish to employ in its off-duty hours than a soldier has to do bayonet practice when he's on leave. Thought was for it a device necessary to certain ends, but thought itself did not interest it. So again, this is a life of complete selfish isolation, which itself is a terrible spiritual pain. Loneliness is one of the greatest spiritual pains. And we know even from human experience that a state of loneliness is a deep cause of personal distress and even the most common reason given for attempts at suicide. Clark Moustakas, a psychologist, in his book entitled Loneliness, quotes a patient describing his inner life. "Lonely," he shouted, "I've been lonely all my life. I've never been an honest person. I've never done anything I really wanted to do, nothing I truly believed in. I don't know what I believe in anymore. I don't know what I feel. I don't know what to do with myself. I wish I could die. How I have yearned and longed for death to come to end this misery. If I had the courage, I would kill myself. I don't know how much more I can stand. My heart fills with terror. I do not really exist. I am nothing. I am dying, but I can't stop breathing. I can't stop living." These were the themes of our talks together: self-denial, estrangement, rejection, excruciating pain, and spreading loneliness, unquote. Now, Moustakas' approach in psychology, somewhat parallel to Kierkegaard's in philosophy, is to regard these kinds of crises of facing one's own despair for Kierkegaard or facing loneliness for Moustakas, to regard these crises as creative opportunities for growth and self-transformation, for a breakthrough. But what would such an experience be like if there were no longer any possibility for change or growth? That would be hell in all its horror. Making a similar point, Father Gabriel Amorth, who is the exorcist for the city of Rome and has written a couple of books about it, his first entitled An Exorcist Tells His Story, he quotes as follows from a demon whom an exorcist is forcing to tell the truth as a final stage before driving him out. And he quotes the devil as saying, or some demon, quote, "In hell, everyone lives folded within himself and torn apart by his regrets. There is no relationship with anyone. Everyone finds himself in the most profound solitude and desperately weeps for the evil he has committed. It is like a cemetery." So there's great remorse, but again, no repentance. And besides this utter loneliness, of course, is a complete hatred, not only of God and self, but also of every other being, including every being next to you in hell. This hatred is such that you are caught up in it and consumed by it and subject to it from all those around you, especially Satan himself, of course. Again, a quote from Cry of a Lost Soul, "We look appalled at our ruined life, hating and suffering. Do you hear? We here drink hatred like water. Above all, we hate God. I hate the devil too, and yet I'm pleased with him because he tries to ruin all of you. The souls in hell continue to be inescapably ordained toward God while being at the same time irretrievably possessed by the devil and obsessed with his presence, what C.S. Lewis calls the miserific vision." And to quote from him in Perelandra again, he says, "As there is one face above all worlds, merely to see which is irrevocable joy, So at the bottom of all worlds, that face is waiting, whose sight alone is the misery from which none who beholds it can recover. And though there seemed to be, and indeed were, 1,000 roads by which a man could walk through the world, there was not a single one which did not lead, sooner or later, either to the beatific or the miserific vision. So you are surrounded and consumed by hatred and spiritual ugliness. Thus the mystic Saint Veronica Giuliani speaks of this in one of her visions of hell. Quote, "Lucifer saw them all and they saw him, just as in heaven the sight of God brings happiness to all the saints. So here in hell, the dreadful form of Lucifer, that hellish monster, brings torment to the damned. Their greatest punishment is the loss of God. This is the pain that Lucifer endures first of all, and then the rest of them participate in it. He blasphemes, and they all blaspheme. He curses, and so do they. He suffers and is in torture, and all suffer and are in torture too. Thus we have here a kingdom of the damned organized as a hierarchy." C.S. Lewis, of course, calls it a lowerarchy in the Screwtape Letters of Possession. Is there any joy or pleasure in hell? Only that of a malevolent and envious spite when another soul is damned. Even though this increases the pain of all in hell, it is selfishly received as a spiteful victory against God. Yet even this quote-unquote joy, which Suareth describes as minima vala vilissima, that is, small, vain, and utterly vile, will eventually be changed into further suffering and will at last end completely when hell will be settled into eternal immobility. Then this spiteful joy will have no further occasion. Now notice that in this first half of the talk, so far all I've done is attempted to describe the spiritual pains of hell. I've said nothing of the physical pains, the eternal fire, which hell seems most known for. Let me turn now to this aspect of things, where I hope to make some contribution to the traditional considerations on the subject. So far, someone may say, the description of the spiritual torments of hell is such that the condemned soul has really done all this to himself. Thus, there really is nothing for which to reproach a loving God in this horrible state of affairs. God, in his loving wisdom, as we believe, has done all he can, including sending his beloved Son to die for us on the cross in order to win souls freely to him in love. If a soul insists on its own lie and separates itself from God, then all the above spiritual pain follows. This is the essence of evil. Again, as Scott Peck says, quote, about a couple of the people he's had in counseling who were very far gone. He says, quote, "A predominant characteristic, however, of the behavior of those I call evil is scapegoating. Because in their hearts they consider themselves above reproach, they must lash out at anyone who does reproach them. They cannot or will not tolerate the pain of self-reproach. The problem is not a defect of conscience, but the effort to deny conscience its due. We become evil by attempting to hide from ourselves. The wickedness of the evil is not committed directly, but indirectly as part of this cover-up process. Evil originates not in the absence of guilt, but in the attempt to escape it. What distinguishes the evil, however, from the rest of us is the specific type of pain they're running from. It's only one particular kind of pain they cannot tolerate, the pain of their own conscience, their warning moral voice, the pain of the realization of their own sinfulness and imperfection. The evil hate the light of goodness which shows them up, the light of scrutiny which exposes them, the light of truth which penetrates their deception." This, then, is the lie. If a person insists on it, then he really brings all the consequences described above upon himself. However, a question arises at this point. Why are any further physical pains, like eternal unquenchable fire, necessary for those in hell? Haven't they made themselves miserable enough? Can this be used as evidence then against faith in a God of love and mercy, perhaps even of justice? Is he just a God of vengeance and revenge who piles on further suffering onto his enemies unnecessarily? Now, concretely, one might ask, sort of as a preliminary point here, why would a loving, perfectly good God even permit such people to go on living in their misery, especially for all eternity? Why not just put them out of their despair and unhappiness by putting them out of existence? That would seem to be a much more humane and loving thing to do. What sense does it make to leave people in horrible misery forever? Just eradicate them, reduce them to nothing, and thus also ultimately simply eradicate hell. Why does a God of mercy not do this? Now, again, we're dealing with deep mysteries, but here I find two responses helpful or intelligible and toward at least some limited understanding. Both responses hinge on the idea that we're simply speaking nonsense and indeed being absurd when we ask this of God, because we're asking him to contradict himself. And as St. Thomas says, nothing that implies contradiction falls under the omnipotence of God. Like, God cannot make it good for us to curse him, because that would be to contradict his own essential goodness. So that would be an absurd request, you see. Now, what would be the contradiction here? Well, first, God has originally created both angelic and human persons as eternal beings. This is part of our very essence. We are not here today and gone tomorrow like the flowers of the field. Although we're part of time, time is only a secondary mode of temporary existence. Fundamentally, we are eternal beings, not eternal in our essence the way God is, but secondarily by his gift. But he makes us as immortal beings. Thus, to ask God to take us out of existence is to ask him to contradict himself, to simultaneously both create and uncreate an immortal being. This is an absurd request. It's like asking God to create a square circle or to put himself out of existence or to make it good for us to curse him, all contradictions to being itself. And to ask God to be God in a contradictory fashion is to reduce him to nonsense and absurdity. Again, as C.S. Lewis says in The Problem of Pain, quote, "Nonsense remains nonsense even when you talk it about God," unquote. Now, Father Garrigou Lagrange, in his book Life Everlasting, quotes a companion, Father Lacordaire, on this point, quote, "God would thus be constrained to undo what he has done and that which he has made to last forever," unquote. The theologian Germain Griset also expresses this point as follows, adding a sort of a qualitative dimension to it. Quote, "If a created person constitutes a self which is not open to his or her own good, that self is not compatible with heavenly communion. God can do nothing about this without either coercing the individual and so destroying freedom and the self which it has constituted, or else annihilating the individual. However, evil is the privation, while freedom and the being of the damned remain good to the extent that they are real. And God, loving those goods which manifest his own goodness, cannot destroy them," that is, without contradicting himself, unquote. Similarly, another response would be that to ask God to put hell out of existence would be to violate his own justice. It would mean that in some sense, the evil had gotten away with their evil, since ultimately it has resulted in nothing more than what Socrates calls a dreamless sleep, if you just die and never have any other consciousness, if non-existence is the final result. This would seem to be a violation of God's justice. And even if you say his love and mercy in some way surpasses justice, still love and mercy cannot contradict justice. This would again ask God to be a contradiction. Thus, deadly sin, deadly hatred of God, as a state of permanent spiteful rejection, would seem to demand a permanent response or punishment. Even the seriousness of the crucifixion would seem to demand that what we're being saved from is more than just a dreamless sleep after a life of terrible evil. We're being saved from eternal maliciousness and the eternal punishment that might go with it. However, this does not mean that God's mercy is no longer operative compared to his justice in relation to those in hell. And so it's not enough to say if you reject the God of love, you have to face the God of justice. Rather, even in hell, justice and mercy continue to operate together. Indeed, St. Thomas says that divine mercy sees to it that those in hell actually suffer less than they deserve. This may be by a direct mitigating grace, or may also have to do with the idea that the evil man, quote, will not live out half his days, unquote, from the Psalms. That is, that the man hardened in evil on earth may be taken out of this life sooner so as not to bury himself deeper in hell. So again, a quote from Cry of a Lost Soul. Under compulsion, I must add that God is merciful even toward us. I affirm many things against my will and must choke out the torrent of abuses. I must choke off the torrent of abuses I would like to vomit out. God was merciful to us by not allowing our wicked wills to exhaust themselves on earth as we would have been prepared to do. This would have increased our faults and pains. He caused us to die before our time, as in my case, or had other mitigating circumstances intervene. Nobody suffers more than he deserves. Oh, if that were not true, I would have such a motive to hate, unquote. But this is not all that can be said in reference to God's loving mercy compared to his justice in regard to hell. I believe that we should expect a deeper and more essential coming together of the two, of justice and mercy, in a mysterious unity even in hell. Certainly we find such a mysterious unity in the case of our own sufferings and punishments here on earth. So again, Lewis, in The Problem of Pain, makes a point of bringing out this mysterious unity. He points out that while our sufferings legitimately may be regarded as in some sense a just response to evil, they are at the same time a mercy, what he calls, quote, a megaphone to rouse a deaf world, unquote, an occasion to recognize that something is wrong in our lives and that changes need to be made. This implication, even in our earthly lives and experience, that justice goes together with mercy, is something that must also be the case with hell. But how can this be so? How is it that the physical pains of hell are not just a vengeful piling on against those who've revolted against God? Thus, some might ask, why can't God at least leave the evil alone if it's not possible to uncreate them? Why must he burn them forever with no relief? Why not at least provide them with some neutral state? Is God just spiteful and vindictive? Here I think the answer lies in the fact that there simply is no such neutral state, short of violating their being as persons, to which the damned could be reduced, which would in any way help them. I've given a brief description of the spiritual state of mind of the damned above. Each soul is a void which cannot be filled except by the God he has rejected. Each longs for this very fulfillment while hating and rejecting it at the same time. Each soul is utterly lonely, utterly without interests, locked in complete boredom and despair, while at the same time locked in impotent hatred, tearing itself apart spiritually. This is a state of the worst possible spiritual pain if left to itself. Thus, my contention is that hell, if the damned soul were left completely to itself and its spiritual horror and regrets, hell would be worse without the physical pains. Hell would be worse without the physical pains, which serve as a distraction from the spiritual pains. From this perspective, the physical pain, example of fire, is indeed a punishment, a justice, but it's also a mercy, in that it is the only possible way for the soul to find some distraction from God, from himself, and from his spiritual state. To be taken out of hell physically, that is, away from the physical pains and ugliness and horror, would be to come closer to God and his creation, the whole of which speaks of God in its very being, its truth and goodness and beauty. But to come closer to God in any way would be the most painful of all punishments. All the souls in hell want to do is flee from all goodness, all truth, all beauty, all positive dimensions of being. But where can they flee when all creation speaks of the glory of God? They must hide from a God who is omnipresent within and without. They seek the most distant place from him, but how can they avoid him? I would say they attempt to avoid him by literally building a physical hell for themselves. Hence, as Father Gabriel Amorth reports, again in the context of an exorcist forcing a demon to speak the truth as a last phase before driving him out, quote, "You do not know anything. It wasn't God who made hell. It was all of us. All of us cooperated," unquote. In other words, this place of physical torment is a desperate attempt to flee from him, from God, and from the supreme spiritual torment of being near him. Again, from Cry of a Lost Soul, quote, "At the moment of my death, my soul showed herself to me as in a mirror, all the graces despised from my youth until my last no to God. I felt myself like an assassin to whom his dead victim is shown during his trial at court. Should I repent? Never. Should I feel ashamed? Never. However, I could not even stand before the eyes of God rejected by me. There was only one thing for me, flight. As Cain fled from the dead body of Abel, so my soul rushed from that scene of horror. Then my soul, as a yellow brimstone shadow, fell headlong into the place of eternal torture. Now he shows himself merciful toward us by not compelling a closer approach than that afforded in this remote inferno. Every step bringing us closer to God would cause us greater pain," unquote. This means that any step out of hell, in terms of a physical place of torment, any step toward creation as God made it, any step toward God, would be worse than the pain of being in hell. Any good thing, any beautiful thing, even any authentically pleasurable thing, speaks and reminds of God reflecting his infinite goodness. Thus, hell must include a rejection and reversal of all goodness and beauty, including all the five senses. Nothing positive or good must be allowed in sight or hearing or taste or touch or smell, because this would remind one of goodness and joy and beauty. All must in fact be filled with the opposite, ugliness and pain, as a way of distraction. Each soul buries itself in the fires of hell just to the point of distraction from his spiritual pain and no further. Even the demons, as both a justice and a mercy, are allowed to subject themselves to matter, to fire, to physical pain as a way of distraction. The physical pains, of course, are very real and must be very terrible to offer any mitigation or distraction, even if imperfect, from the infinite spiritual pain and despairing self-reproach at the loss of God. But both justice and mercy are operational here. However, at this point, someone may object that calling the physical pains of hell both a justice and a loving mercy as a distraction sounds just a little too slick and easy as an explanation purporting to get God off the hook. Perhaps we're dealing here with mere semantics. In other words, the words sound good, but what could they possibly mean? Now, to try to understand this a little better, let me offer some antecedents in our own experience here on earth to this state of affairs. First, I'll give a trivial personal example having nothing to do with spiritual pain. When I was in college, I discovered a partial remedy for what I considered at the time to be a serious discomfort: the itching caused by static electricity rampant in our dormitory. A solution I discovered was to take a shower as hot as I could stand and train the scalding water on the places where it itched. not to be done or recommended. I've read since that it may cause a heart attack, so forget that. There was a balancing point where the pain of the scalding water would overwhelm and blot out the pain of the itch. And this was felt as a triumphant achievement and relief. Though one bit more and the pain of the hot water would be too great and I'd have to back off, you see. And I'd get out of the shower with red blotches from all the hot water, you see. But I'd got rid of the itch, you see. Now, on a much more serious level, we can ask, why do some people actively and intentionally cause themselves great physical pain? For example, those who cut themselves, which have become recognized more and more in modern psychology as a serious difficulty. A number of psychological studies have been done recently on this phenomenon with such titles as, quote, self-injury when pain feels good. Another title, cutting, understanding and overcoming self-mutilation. And a third book, A Bright Red Scream, Self-Mutilation and the Language of Pain. One can see right away from these titles that we're not just dealing here with a relatively soft college kid worried about static electricity, but with a whole new level of seriousness. What these books stress is that self-mutilation is an attempt at a type of self-help, a more morbid type of self-help, giving some sort of immediate relief from deeply distressing mental symptoms, such as mounting anxiety or loneliness, despair, self-hatred, anger, perhaps requiring that it be suppressed before a significant other, or feelings of shame and guilt, whether authentic or not, or feelings of depersonalization after having been used terribly by another person, or fear of rapidly fluctuating emotions or racing thoughts. These have been some of the descriptions that those who've cut themselves have given. And so as the author Stephen Levenkron writes in his book, Cutting, Understanding and Overcoming Self-Mutilation, he says, quote, why self-mutilate? Self-mutilators have many different reasons for their actions and are tormented by a spectrum of different feelings. Yet I consistently encounter two characteristics in all self-mutilators. First, a feeling of mental disintegration, of inability to think. And secondly, a rage that can't be expressed or even consciously perceived toward a powerful figure or figures in their life, usually a parent. For the self-mutilator, the experience of one or both of these feelings is unbearable and must therefore be drowned out, as they report, by some immediate method. The self-mutilator is someone who has found that physical pain can be a cure for emotional pain. It is someone who, for one reason or another, has absolutely no outlet for her emotional pain and therefore no relief from it. All she has is that short period of time when it is temporarily overpowered or drowned out by physical pain. This is the experience of self-inflicted physical pain as a triumphal relief from spiritual pain. Again, as Mary Lee Strong describes in her book, A Bright Red Scream, Self-Mutilation and the Language of Pain, quote, cutting substitutes the pain inside with a physical pain, which is easier to handle. Self-harm is like a catharsis for those inner feelings. However, in the long run, it doesn't alleviate the psychic pain, it just distracts from it, unquote. Now, of course, here I'm not at all implying that all cutters are like those in hell, evil, not at all. I'm simply implying the converse, that all those in hell are trying desperately to deal with their own radical self-disintegration and despair. And let me emphasize that. I mean, that you can't reverse an if-then clause. All I'm saying that if you're in hell, you're subject to mental disarrangement. But I'm not saying anybody with mental problems is thereby going to hell. That would be like if I said, if you're an elephant, you're over 500 pounds as an animal. And if you try to reverse that, if you're dealing with an animal of over 500 pounds, it must be an elephant. That doesn't work. Obviously, that could be a rhino or a hippo or whatever. So I'm only saying that those in hell, besides their evil, have a mental falling apart. And they're trying to deal with their own radical self-disintegration and despair and totally impotent rage. And they do so by immersing themselves in physical pain. It's their only way to even partially relieve their spiritual pain. Their state would be worse, more miserable, more unhappy without the physical pain. Thus, to quote Levenkron's description in one case study, quote, "Jessica is an extreme example of how people are capable of revising the meaning of pain from something to be avoided to something that is pursued and embraced. She anticipated her pain-inducing experiences with excitement because she knew that she would soon be escaping from her feelings of loneliness and abandonment. The pain she inflicted upon herself came as a welcome trade-off from the terrible feelings and transported her away from her loneliness into a trance state where she was oblivious to her painful emotions." Again, let me quote the opening lines of Edward Welch's little book, Self-Injury, When Pain Feels Good, quote, "If you have never purposely hurt yourself, it seems impossible to understand those who have. After all, don't living creatures avoid pain? But if you have purposely hurt yourself, such behavior seems necessary, normal, even right. In fact, like a diabetic giving herself an injection, it can feel like a temporary cure," unquote. Though such solutions never entirely work, I submit that we have here a clue as to the state of mind of those in hell, and a clue as to why the physical pains of hell are not only a justice in relation to sin, but also a mercy in relation to utter spiritual abandonment and misery. The physical pains of hell would seem to fit then with a God of mercy, not only a God of justice. God allows the damned to be as remote from him as is possible, since it is his presence which is most unbearable. Yet there's no way to be truly distant, physically or spiritually, from a God who's all present and all knowing, continually with each person both within and without. It is only through total immersion in sufficient physical pain to distract the soul from its spiritual state that some relief from loneliness, abandonment, impotent rage, and despair can be had. This is indeed a sobering thought, even if nobody talks about it much anymore, as Pope Benedict said. The eternal pains of hell are in fact compatible with the God of infinite love in such a way that his love is triumphant even in the place of damnation. We have an indication here as to how God can remain all in all in a final consummation of loving goodness, though hell remains interminably. End of part one.